Hello and welcome to Watch the Throne. What a lovely day. This is episode 39, Mad Max Fury Road from 2015. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
I live, I die, I live again. I'm Mike Manzi.
Witness me. Before we get into our guests, we had to bring on two heavy hitter guests here on the Watch the Throne podcast. I want to say, Mike, you know, we've been talking for almost a year now about Charlize Theron movies, and yep. I didn't realize how much it would mimic the Fury Road in that, like, we just have to, like, get through it. But now we are riding shiny and chrome into Valhalla. We are here now.
Yes.
We are basically, the reason we did this podcast is this movie. We have made it.
Yeah, dare I say, it's been a little mediocre up until this part. But I do sort of feel like, in a way, I relate a little more to Max. We've sort of traversed the movie wastelands of the Gulag salt flats and have finally arrived in sight of some aqua cola to sort of quench our movie thirst.
And what I realized, and what I also told you today, was that we've been calling the awards the golden wallpaper, the golden teeth, the golden corn, whatever, but that's not, I mean, we just use the golden because of the golden peaches and the golden hot dogs.
Right, yeah.
But it's really, we gotta do for the show, we gotta do the black and chrome whatever, like the black and chrome wallpapers, the black and chrome corn, the black and chrome teeth, whatever it's gonna be. You know, the black and coal or black and chrome guzzling awards. I don't know. But whatever it's going to be black and chrome and not gold, because those are the colors of Watch the Throne.
Yeah, I don't know how we didn't remember that going into this.
Because we're not good at this.
No, we're not as good as, yeah, we're not. But we're here now, and yeah, I like that you picked up on that. The shiny chrome is definitely the way to go for the award this year.
So like I said, we do have two guests for this. They are both shiny. They are both chrome. First up, from the Wistful Thinking podcast, representing both hosts from that show who wanted to be on this episode, we have Jordan Pullen-Clark. Hello, Jordan.
Hi.
I am so sorry. I've apologized to Kara multiple times that she could not be on this episode, because this is like her shit entirely. So I hope
her
and yourself proud.
It's also mine, and it's a podcast, so you guys can't see how big I'm smiling right now. and I have a I have a water bottle in my hands, and I'm gripping it really, really hard. I'm just so excited.
If I may mention just quickly, Joy, before we intro our next guest, Kara is going to be on my crossover episode for my show. So for Third Time's a Charm next month, we reviewed Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome. So I've been watching all these movies all month long, and it's been a blast.
Well, coming soon to the Cage Club Podcast Network, whether it's on September 3rd or whenever, Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome, an epically long but probably wonderful episode of Third Time's a Charm. Also with us, also shiny, also chrome, we have Chris Podcast Mattiello. Hello, Chris.
Hello. My blood type is O positive, if you need to know in advance, which means I'm probably fucked in the apocalypse.
You're the universal donor?
Is it high octane feral blood?
No, negative is the universal donor. Positive just sucks.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm glad that we have a doctor on here to explain blood to us, because I knew that
an organic mechanic. Nice.
I can receive from, like, nobody, essentially, so RIP me.
RIP you. Well, so here we are, Fury Road, the movie that we were like, oh, yeah, we'll do Charlize Theron, because her movies are great. She's got Fury Road, she's got Atomic Blonde, she's got Young Adult. The rest will be good. Nope. But here we are. It, you know, like when we got to The Matrix or John Wick, it was like, oh, this was almost worth the entire journey just because this movie is so goddamn good.
Yeah.
I saw this movie first. So here's the scene. Let's go through everybody when we first saw this movie. So I saw this movie at a special advanced screening.
Oh.
Humble brag. At the Alamo Draft House in Austin. I remember I was doing like a weekend film thing called, I think, Noir City. So I was seeing like 9 like 30s and 40s noir movies all in black and white at one Draft House location. And I had to skip 2 because I was like, oh, I got a free ticket to see Fury Road. This shit's probably going to rule. Let me go do that. And so I skipped 2 movies. I went down to a different Draft House, got there. I think, I want to say George Miller was there. I want to say maybe Robert Rodriguez was there. I don't remember. I know there was an interview. What I do vividly remember is that I ordered a pizza before the movie started. The pizza got to me about 45 minutes in, and by the time I picked up my first slice, the pizza was cold because I could not take my eyes off the screen. That this movie is so engrossing and just so balls out, ovaries out, whatever adjective, whatever noun you want to use, from the beginning to the end, that I was just like, I can't take my eyes off the screen, because if I miss a single frame, I'm going to regret it. And it is so goddamn good, and I love this movie, and I can't wait to talk about it for what will probably be like, I don't know, 6 hours.
Yeah, I get it. I get into like my whole history with Mad Max over on the other show, but as far as this film, I went to the movies and saw it alone, and I just remember sitting in the theaters from the opening, being a Mad Max fan, sitting from the opening, very much anticipating this release. From the start, just being engrossed with this thing. Like, it's just, from the jump, it's just intense and extreme and barely ever lets up to give you a breath. And when it does, I feel like your eyes are like looking all around the frame to take in the madness that is going on screen and everything. But I remember sitting there by myself, like it was a pretty big crowd, and all the reactions in the theater were awesome. Like, that's what really got me. Is like, this was one of those movies where I was really glad people were like making noise and stuff, because everybody, it was playing really well for everybody. It all felt like we were on the same page. We wanted to be there. We were getting more than I think we were expecting, and seeing stuff that haven't seen since and hadn't seen before, and there's just nothing like this movie, and I just think it's amazing. And then later on, I mean, I went and they re-released it in the black and chrome edition in the theater mm-hmm. near me, so I got to see that version also. I went back to the theaters to check that out. I like that. It's on a different level. I think I like the color more. I kind of miss the reds of the blood and the fire to go along, and maybe the rust as well to go along with the chrome. But whatever version, it's just great.
Jordan?
I live in a really small town that has a movie theater, but it's like everything there is super old and like not great. I saw this there with two of my roommates, and I just remember that the sound was shitty and the picture was shitty, and I still loved it so much. And like, really the only thing I remember about like after the first time that I saw it was that my roommate and I couldn't stop talking about Doof Warrior. Like, Doof Warrior changed our lives.
Breakout star.
And I just knew that I had to watch it like 100 more times.
I love it. Chris?
Right when it came out, you know, I'd already gotten really good word of mouth before it actually dropped. And a friend and I, and a nice tall bubbly glass of water, went to see this movie, Shiny and Green, Into Valhalla. And I must have looked like a 4-year-old seeing Santa for the first time or something like that. Because I just was, my mouth must have been wide open. My eyes were extremely wide. And I just took it all in, and like the moment that it was over, I think it was like a matinee. It was like an early show, because I didn't have anything to do at that point in my life, like work or anything like that. But I'm pretty sure I saw it again that night, because it was that good and that exciting. And perfect in every way.
Oh, that's awesome. I can't remember. I think the last time I saw the same movie twice in a day was Batman Returns, when it came out in theaters, like when I was like 8 or 9 or whatever. But that's awesome that you saw it twice in one day.
Immediately called people to come and see it.
I feel really jealous of all of you that it sounds like everybody's seen it more than once in the theater except me, and I've only gotten to see it once really big like that.
I think I only saw it once in the theaters, because I just generally, I should have seen it again, but I only saw it the once. So you're not alone, Jordan.
Okay, good.
I did look it up in my email that at the screening that I saw, George Miller was there, Hugh Keyes Byrne was there, and Morton Joe himself, Toe Cutter from the first one.
Nice.
And the Q&A was moderated or led by Robert Rodriguez. So wow. I remember there was even a thing in the trivia, I think. I don't know if it was at this screening or another one, but like Robert Rodriguez just like a fanboy gushing over this, because like 80% of this movie is practical effects. And I remember him just being like, how did you do this? Like how is this possible? You know what I mean, yeah. For somebody who like is so gritty and like shoots and chops and mixes and everything, like Robert Rodriguez is one of those like gritty filmmakers who we're going to do eventually at some point on Cinemakers, I think, because he's just one of those guys who like does everything like, you know, himself, and he's like, let's do it practical, let's do it cheap. And here it's just sort of like the ultimate, like, let's just figure out a way to do this and just do it right. Yeah.
It's so incredible. That's one of my favorite parts about this movie. It's the reason I like the Fast movies too. It just looks so much better when it's real. And I had spent like 30 minutes before we recorded just like watching videos of them making it, and it's just the most incredible thing.
Yeah.
It's, oh, I can't even, like, they sat down and they were like, what's all the craziest stuff we can do? Okay, what's the level right above that? Let's do it. And they did.
Yeah, that's something I think about constantly while watching, is just the logistics of this as far as like directing and filmmaking. Because, I mean, Rodriguez, I don't think he's alone in the community, because I feel like I read something where the Cinemaker we covered, Steven Soderbergh, didn't he? He was like, he recently wrote something about he had seen this and was like, I couldn't imagine directing like a shot of this movie. Like, it's just so crazy and beyond like what is being done out there as far as like complexity and practical effects and stuff. So yeah, I mean, it's just, it gets all the accolades and it deserves it.
Those swinging poles.
Yeah,
it took them 3 months. 3 months to do the swinging poles.
I thought of Circus. I thought of you there with the swinging poles.
Well, they hired somebody from Cirque to teach the stunt guys Chinese pole. That's part of what took so long.
In the world of the big blockbuster and connected universes and Hollywood studios, that this movie exists, it must be some sort of miracle. I said that about Batman, but that was more about Cinemakers, Christopher Nolan season. I said that about Batman, but more about Nolan being kind of a low-key guy directing Batman. Like, that was a miracle. This existing, like, 30 years and change after the last one, which is kind of, at that point, been relegated to a joke, that this existed is mind-blowing to me. It's beautiful that it does, but, like, it's stunning that they gave the guy who did Happy Feet so much money
and the Pig another films sequel as well. To, I mean,
yeah,
Pigs
another
run
another sequel to his exploding car
yeah,
movies.
Yeah, Pigs are thematic through the Mad Max movies as well, which is kind of weird also, but yeah, and George Miller is no spring chicken at this point either. Like, he's in his 70s. He's up there. He's just crazy, though. That's it. He's just crazy enough to get it done, because this movie has faced lots and lots of setbacks. Like, it almost never did happen, you know? And it kind of, you're right, it kind of is a miracle, because every odd was against it, yet here it is.
I mean, a couple episodes ago, Mike, when we did Prometheus, it was supposed to happen then. Like, Charlize mm-hmm. was in it then, and she dropped out of Prometheus so that she could do this movie. Then it got delayed again, and she was like, okay, I can do Prometheus, and had to take the smaller part. I was looking in the IMDb Tribune, as Chris calls it, and it seems like this, I mean, this movie was supposed to start, like, was supposed to come with, like, 2003, starring Mel Gibson, and that didn't happen. Jeremy Renner really wanted to be Max, and, like, Channing Tatum was considered for the role of Max. Like, it feels like this movie was sort of in development, or, like, bandied about for, like, 15 years almost, until it was finally made in 2015. What's interesting, and I don't know if this is true, or if it's still true, if it was ever true, is that also, according to IMDb, Charlize has said that George Miller wants to make a spin-off just about Furiosa, mm-hmm. and that Tom Hardy signed on to do 3 Mad Max movies.
Yeah.
But I don't know. So, like, as we're recording this week, Christopher, or maybe last week, Christopher McQuarrie, the director of Rogue Nation and Mission Impossible Fallout, basically said, I don't want to do another Mission Impossible movie, which is sort of understandable, because, like, after you make Fallout, where the hell do you go? Because that movie is so
how could
goddamn
he make another
good.
Movie, period, to top that?
Exactly. And so it's like this one. Like, you make Fury Road, why, if you're George Miller or Tom Hardy or Charlize Theron, would you ever want to do another one? Because, like, yeah, there's a chance it could be as good or better, but, like, what are the odds of that actually happening? Because, like, everything in this movie is, like, so unbelievable and so done for the first time, and, like, there's so much magic here that I understand the impulse to want to do it again, but can you?
No.
Yeah, I don't think so. And I don't know if anyone should try.
Yeah, no, yeah, no one should pick up the reins to this, absolutely. I mean, it's kind of interesting because they were able to recast Max in sort of like this James Bond way, and the yep. character's movies don't really have a tight continuity either. He's more of like a folk hero or a legend or something, so they're right. like just retelling the story of Max and getting the details wrong or different from time to time. But I do feel like this has to be George Miller. It's just his blood, sweat, and tears in it. I mean, originally it came, you know, from him being an emergency room medic, so like he got the idea for doing Mad Max partially from seeing like road crash victims and everything like that. So I just feel like it's so ingrained in his sensibilities from there out. And each movie has been getting more and more insane. Like, you know, this movie shows you things you've never seen before, but so I feel did the first one and the second one and even the third one. But yeah, it just feels like they've plateaued, like much like the Citadel. There's like really nowhere else to go here. We've reached the top, I feel. Like you could, yeah, I'd just do them in book or comic form, you know, expand the universe in that way. But as far as the movies go, it's like you did it. Like, you know, call it a day.
Yeah.
To go to what Jordan was saying before, could you imagine if this movie came out in 2003, how much hideous cartoony CGI there would have been in this?
Yeah, especially where George Miller was at the time with all of his talking animal stuff and like really embracing what digital graphics can do. I mean, there's a lot of hidden CGI in this movie as well, but it's just like minimal wire stuff, I guess, and like her arm, Furiosa's arm and stuff. But yeah, it's just crazy how it's the same guy. His sensibilities blow my mind.
On Wistful Thinking for our Boatcast series this summer. We watched Waterworld, which... Yes. I've only kind of seen the other Mad Max movies. I told this story on our podcast, too, so I'll tell it kind of short. I used to be an intern at The Onion, and when I was there, I was a research intern, so they would just be like, hey, we need something that looks like this. Can you watch a bunch of stuff, make us clips so we have visual references? So they were doing a thing called Future News when I was there. I watched a bunch of dystopian movies, and the Mad Maxes were some of them, and so that's like my only frame of reference for Mad Max. I barely remember having watched them. We watched Waterworld, and I said, Kara, this is just Mad Max, but opposite, right? Like, in one, they're in the desert, and now we're in the water, and it's basically the same movie, except this one's bad, and those are good. And she was like, yeah, I don't know, maybe. And then she watched them for your podcast, Mike, and she was like, yeah, no, they're the same. But so anyway, I went into this having just watched Waterworld, which is terrible, but a lot of the themes and ideas are the same. And it's just fascinating to be like, okay, this is how you poorly execute this, and this is how you beautifully execute this. But I think part of it, I mean a small part of it, is that this movie is rated R, and that movie is rated PG-13. This movie doesn't shy away from, like, gore. This movie's disgusting.
Yeah.
But it really, really helps with the world building of it, that it's gross a lot of the time.
Apparently, the Warner Brothers made a PG-13 version and an R-rated version, and then tested both and decided to release the R-rated version, which I'm so glad it did.
Yeah.
Because
yeah,
it comes from that same sort of era where, like, within a year, like, this and Deadpool and probably a couple other movies
Logan,
came out. They're like,
right, yeah.
Well, I think Logan's sort of like a result of Deadpool, but it feels like this and Deadpool, like, from different studios at the same time, were just like, hey, we can, you know, still make $1 billion if we release an R-rated movie, if it's good enough and if people want to go see it. Like, this movie, I think the budget was $150 million and made worldwide almost $400 million, which not as successful as Deadpool, but still made a lot of money on this movie. It is really gross, but I think, you know, in terms of the things that, I mean, I don't know, I'm not a parent, I don't know, but it feels like there's not a lot in here that, like, I feel like you could bring a younger kid to this easier than other R-rated movies. Like, there's no language. There's not a ton of blood. I mean, there's a lot of gross stuff, but not a lot of blood. There's sort of implied nudity and sort of slight nudity, but far less than other movies. Like, it kind of feels not like a hard R, aside from, like, the gruesome, grisly, like, Immortan Joe getting his face, like, literally ripped off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It feels like it's sort of, you know, it is R-rated, but it seems like, hey, you could kind of bring, you know, your 14 or 15 year old to this and not be like a bad parent. In fact, be a cool parent.
Or a cool uncle.
Yeah.
I watched a cool YouTube analysis by a channel called Rant and Bollocks. I would guess Irish accent. Apologies to all Irish people listening to this if I'm wrong. And he talks about how this movie does have a lot of the sentimentalities of a children's movie. In fact, he throughout it compares it to The Wizard of Oz in a lot of ways, which is pretty fascinating. And I won't try to copy what he's saying there. Go watch it. But yeah, it does, because it's got this whole idea of, like, working together with people for the greater good, and, like, how really just, like, the collective, basically this movie is about just working together to fulfill a goal. And that is how many kids movies, like fucking Homeward Bound and, like, with Cars, like, there's so many kids movies that are about that. And it is, there's nothing in this that's that bloody, gory, violent. Mm-hmm. It's weird. It's the beginning is kind of creepy. People go kaboom. But at the same time, like, it pulls heartstrings like a lot of those kids' movies too. Like, there's no movie that is this big, loud, and, like, explosion-y that also makes me ugly cry as hard.
I ugly cried a lot too.
Every time.
The whole second half when they go back. The whole second half I just cried.
Something else that kinda adds to, like, the kid-friendly, I guess, aspect of this too, is, like, they really pumped up the color. Like, we talked about, we mentioned the black and chrome version, but the theatrical release is, like, really saturated. Like, they really, especially compared to the last three movies, like, and I feel like that, too, just lends it sort of, like, a more of a fictional reality, I guess. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, almost watching a cartoon to a degree, even though it's, like, an itchy and scratchy cartoon. Mm-hmm. It's not a Bugs Bunny cartoon. But, I mean, movies can sort of be rated just for themes or like intensity too, because it reminds me of one of my favorite all-time sort of like warnings on a movie rating. I saw this for Jurassic Park 3. I remember in theaters it said, "Warning: extreme sci-fi terror." You know, so like there's things like that exclude being shot or, you know, showing blood or nudity and stuff that could also, if there's enough of it in the movie, and there certainly is in this one, this movie is intense from start to finish. So, like, I just feel like the feeling you get from watching this might overwhelm someone of a younger age to a degree. But also, like, for all the other reasons we mentioned, the lack of nudity, blood, some consequence to the violence and stuff that's more sort of cartoonish nature, I would definitely rather take my nephew to this than some of the other R-rated movies if I had a list to pick from.
Going back to what you were saying about the color, about the ramped up saturation, apparently George Miller said that there were two rules for the production, that the cinematography would be as colorful as possible to differentiate it from other post-apocalyptic movies that are usually all like drab and gray. We're talking about The Road with Kara, exactly. That's what I was just about to say. Like, everything in that movie except for like the Coca-Cola can is just like the same color. Like, it's just all that like disgusting
just
brown.
Ash, yeah.
Yeah. So that was number one. And number two, he said that the art direction should be as beautiful as possible because he felt that in a world like this, everyone would try to find whatever shred of beauty they could in the world and just, like, cling to it. And so, like, I don't know if I've talked about it on this podcast, but on other podcasts, to be sure, my mega crush, Riley Keough, like, I love that her hair is so, like, vividly red that, like, in this, like, crazy world, whether that's her natural hair color in this world or not, but, like, she's not going to be taken down by this world. Like, she's going to, like, stand out from the crowd and just, like, all these, like, crazy, just hyper-saturated, like, little bursts of life are just so great to see. They just pop against the otherwise like dirty, dusty landscape that also looks gorgeous.
There's all these little details of it that, like, I feel like that's not just like a rule that he used for production. Like, that's a rule that every character in this movie follows. Like, not all of it is pretty because they do live in the desert. It's mostly just brown. But like the details of like how there's an arm on the outside of her rig, and if you look at the details of the cars that everybody else is driving, like, there's personality to them where it's not just this like drab world. Even the war boys like give personality to, what's his name, Nux.
Mm-hmm. Nux,
he's got his little tumors that have smiley faces.
Barry
on
and
them.
Larry, his mates. Barry and Larry.
Barry and Larry, right. His mates. Just like the little details like that really, really bring life to a genre that doesn't always have that.
Yeah, and also I think of like the wheels, right? Like their steering wheels, like all personalized. And something that runs through all the movies, Max in his car. Like that, you know, like every time in his movies, like he's, or at least after the second one, he's trying to get his car back. And it's just like, you know, it's his one possession. Like they each, that's kind of interesting. I never really considered that before either though, but I like that a lot. And yeah, all the war boys look alike too for the most part. Yeah, if you look a little closer, or like Nux has this engine sort of tattooed on his chest, but it's like, you know, more of like a brand, I guess. And then his Lancer has sort of like this really distorted Joker scarring going on with his smile and stuff. So it is pretty cool. They try to personalize everything.
I don't think it's necessarily her choice, but when you talk about brands, you talk about tattoos. Like, I love that we are introduced to Furiosa by like the brand on the back of her neck. Like, that just sort of defines who she is and like what she is. I don't know that that's necessarily her choice. Like, that might just be a mark of her role. I don't know exactly, you know, the mythology of the Mad Max universe, but like, it's just such a cool introduction that like this is what makes her in a way, you know.
Yeah, and even I think to a bigger degree, like her arm, right? Like the idea that she's like I'm gonna cobble together this out of whatever is around. I mean, I don't know, I think like she could have either gone around with one arm or decided like I'm gonna build like this steampunk arm and like, you know, keep going and be, you know, someone with two arms now, like no matter how it has to happen and stuff. Because something about like the branding that's interesting is like that's what freaks Max out the most. Like, he's getting his back tattooed with all of like his details about him, his blood type, where he's from. He's a road warrior. He was an ex-cop and all this local, you know, universal donor. And then they come at him with that with that Skullfire brand, that like Ghost Rider head, and he like freaks the fuck out and like won't let that happen. So it's almost like it represents a like a loss of your identity. Like he doesn't want that taken away. He doesn't want to be conformed by Immortan Joe like the rest of his like crew and everything. And so I feel like her arm is almost like in defiance of that brand in a way, saying like, this is the piece of me that I created that, you know, belongs to me. Like my arm was taken away, but I brought it back myself or something.
One of my favorite parts is at the beginning when they're trying to, maybe it's, I can't remember if it's before or after they brand him, but he's trying to get away and he's still handcuffed. He comes to that ledge and looks down and is like, oh shit. And then he jumps onto that hook and swings himself around. And for like a brief second, you're like, oh, he might get away. He doesn't. But I love, love, love that jump and that catch.
That whole like sequence is like breathless because he's just getting chased through this place that he's never been, and you've never been there as the viewer, and like you just don't know what he's gonna do. And like he just, there's like that little even moment of tension before he jumps where he has to like basically run toward the people chasing him so that he can just then run away and get a little bit more momentum. It's just like that whole thing is just, it's just amazing. And then you realize, I guess, as soon as he gets all the way out there, that like, oh no, momentum's going to bring you back. I mean, he takes one or two out with him, but still at the same time, there is that glimmer. You're right, Jordan, where it's like, oh, he might get away. But in this movie, like, I don't think you can ever really get away from anything. Like, you know, he talks about when they get all the way out to the east where there is nothing, you know, and they're trying to figure out if they should keep going or go back. He's like, I guarantee you, you can go for 160 days or whatever that way and there's nothing. Like, he knows there's nothing out there. The prospect of nothing, I guess, is better than being captured by, you know, Immortan Joe and Nux and all those guys.
Yeah, and that sort of escape attempt is so claustrophobic in the tunnels and everything, and he's running through like all the different sort of compartments there, and then when he opens that door, it's just such a breath of fresh air, and it just opens up that whole world, and you see the Citadel and you see the giant brand like carved into the mountain and shit, and you're like, oh my god, like where the fuck did they bring him? Like, it's almost like a nightmare to me, to be honest. Like the imagery, just like it's coming fast and intense and stuff, and like, I don't know, like it's scary, but I'm not afraid, but it's very unnerving for sure.
And it's a sequence that leads very seamlessly into the introduction and contains part of the introduction to the War Boys and Immortan Joe's kingdom and really just the setup to the film and the inciting incident. And it does that. That's part of one of my favorite things that this movie does is it never stops to explain anything in this weird apocalypse bondage WWF universe. A lesser movie, but maybe like every movie, which is a lesser movie because every movie is a lesser movie than this, would stop and have Furiosa be like, ah, yes, a Immortan Joe came into my village and he took my arm and his bride's, and that's how he got his mask, and just stop the movie dead in its tracks to explain shit that no one needs to have explained to them, and just be like, better if you didn't. Mad Max never takes the opportunity to slow the pace down. It can't afford it. It's high octane all the way through, and I really appreciate that it doesn't feel the need to treat its audience like a bunch of morons.
No, and it makes me so accepting of a bunch of things that don't make any sense to me, but I'm just like, yeah, no, this is the world, great, cool, let's go.
Yeah.
And they keep it so simple that it's just easy. Like, they use so many words that I don't understand. I don't care.
Oh, yeah.
I'm just like, yeah, cool.
Doof is like the perfect example, I feel, of all of it. It's like, what the fuck is that? I have no idea, but okay, like, I buy it, I believe it, it belongs here.
And I'm into it.
Yeah.
It's, but if there is any character I would read a Star Wars Extended Universe-esque novel about, it is Doof Warrior.
I mean, there's also, like, those creatures, like the, I don't know what they're called, but just the things, like, walking on the stilts in the desert, and it's like, I don't know what those are, the movie's not gonna tell you, but like, yeah, cool, like, I'm down, like, that's, sure, why not?
And when it actually does, I feel like the one time it actually does something, it earns it so well, because like the one time it does it is when he tells Furioso his name at the very end when she's about to die, you know, like it's so perfect when he says, my name is Max. It's great, you know, because she even asks like once or twice, what's your name? I'll call you fool, like this and that. And then, like, yeah, he doesn't have to be like, my name is Max Rokitansky, I had a wife and a daughter, you know, I've fought my way through Thunderdome, like, all this stuff. Like, I saved the kids from the crack in the earth. Like, no. Like, it doesn't matter. And I love that it doesn't matter either, but that moment is one of my favorite. That's when I start to swell up at the end there, when he says his name at the end.
Because, like, his first and his last line in the movie, the first in the voiceover and the last one there, it's just him, you know, telling someone, either it's us or Charlize, Furiosa, what his name is. And, like, this is, like, his name is on the title, but as very many, you know, fragile male ego people cried out when this movie came out, like, this is not a Max movie, this is a Furiosa movie, this is a wives movie, this is a movie where gender politics and gender dynamics matter. And what's also super cool behind the scenes, what I didn't realize, is that George Miller's wife edited this, and he said that he wanted her to edit this so that a man wouldn't, because if a man edited this, it would look like every other action movie of all time, so we wanted to avoid that. But the craziest thing is they shot 470 hours of footage that took her 3 months to watch. And so, whoa, like, the 470 of those hours became these two, and holy shit, did she pick the right 2 hours.
We don't even know. We've not seen the rest. Who knows? There could be more. It could be better.
Yeah, they could do, like the Anchorman extra cut of all the stuff that was deleted. They made it to, like, an extra movie on the Blu-ray or something like that. But that's awesome. That reminds me of how, like, Marsha Lucas, I think, George Lucas's wife, edited the original Star Wars, A New Hope, and, like, apparently saved that from being total shit. Like, apparently, like, he did a cut and the studio was like, yeah, you know, you're out of your effing mind, and she went through and salvaged it, basically. So that's really awesome.
He also brought in Eve Ensler as a consultant on it. Eve Ensler, who wrote the vagina.
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I remember that. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Let's talk a little bit about Charlize, the reason that we're here today to talk about this movie in general. I still think, Mike, that, like, young adult is a better showcase of who she is, just because she's in, like, every frame of that movie, basically. But this sort of, in a way, kind of feels like, just like John Wick, like, I think we sort of said it about young adult, just in a different way. Like, this feels like what her career has been building to. Like, going even all the way back to Mighty Joe Young, when we were talking about, like, they're driving through downtown LA or wherever they are, and she's, like, hanging on the side of that truck. Like, there's these glimpses of Charlize, the action star. We have not yet picked out what the archetypal roles, if that even is a category we're going to do for the awards. But I feel like there's a few different, very dynamic, different Charlize, and I don't even know if archetypal role is the best way to do it. It sort of feels like the type of actor she is, like, because there's Charlize the action star, there's Charlize the dramatic performer, there's Charlize like the comedian, and I feel like Cage did a lot of different things, but I feel like in terms of, like, what she does, like, she's really dynamic in, like, a handful of different things, and, you know, this, in a way, like I was saying, feels like the culmination of, like, this is action Charlize. We're gonna see it again in a few movies with Atomic Blonde, which is also awesome, but, like, this feels like, oh yeah, like, we can sort of see this coming through the 38 episodes that we did to get to this point.
Yeah, it does kind of feel like a culmination of everything, because, like, you know, she's great in everything pretty much that she's in, like, even if what she's in isn't always the best thing to watch, but she usually is really good because she's a really good actress. What is kind of interesting about this performance is it's mostly like a performance of extremes, where she's, like, extremely angry or extremely mad, or, like, shooting people driving, like, but there are moments in here, subtle looks and things to Max, or that moment in the desert where she breaks down and stuff, where she has to sort of, like, turn on a dime or, like, switch real quick and go from, like, angry to despair in, like, you know, a cut or something like that of two shots and stuff. And she can pull it off. Like, I really feel like, yeah, young adult, you know, she had more range, I guess, to display as far as, like, you know, gradually, like, showing you what she can do as far as, like, dramatic performances and stuff. But here, like, she's holding up all the action and stuff, and she's pulling out, like, the dramatic things when it's called for. And it's, I think, hardest of all is all that stuff being believable in an action movie, you know? Like, as much as I love, love, love Face Off and other John Woo films, from time to time, they get a bit too melodramatic. I think he's just gets to a little too soap opery sometimes when he gets to the love story or the dramatic side of it. And other times in other action movies, that stuff can be laughable or fall flat. As far as her performance here, like, I just totally buy everything that's going on. It just feels like she is this person. Everything just feels genuine and is reigning true. So.
And I think what helps me, especially with my hair blindness, is that because she shaved her head, it does feel like a different kind of person. I mean, we talked about when we did A Million Ways to Die in the West a couple episodes ago that, like, because of this movie, she shaved her head and she had to wear a wig for that. The wig she wore just was Charlize. You know what I mean? Like, it felt like, oh, that's just her hair. Like, that's not a wig. That's just her hair. But here, it's like, oh, no, this is, like, a dynamically drastic different person. And it's, you know, great.
She and Tom Hardy have, I feel like, I'm not an actor, but what I assume is a very, very, very hard job in this movie because there's almost no dialogue. It's mostly just face acting. She especially, I feel like, is able to bring a kind of, like, depth to this character without saying a lot of words.
The only other time in recent memory, I can really think of a performance that did that so well was Sally Hawkins in Shape of Water.
Oh, yeah.
And in both for both Charlize and Sally Hawkins, they were the most grounded, down to earth performances in universes full of weird, cartoony shit. And you need someone to tether you to the ground, or else characters like Doof Warrior and Immortan Joe and Nux are gonna just take you into the fucking stratosphere. And so she really does carry a lot of this movie on her shoulders, along with Tom Hardy, who has, like, what, like 12 lines or something insane like that.
And he's even wearing a muzzle for, like, a quarter
of the film,
too. His
face is covered for 40 minutes. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we talked about, you know, Batman and Cinemakers before, but he's kind of wearing, like, the Bane muzzle too.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So
right. That's another thing quickly I wanted to address, is that I really started kind of paying attention to this during Cinemakers when we were doing the Insomnia episode, because they were shooting in the land of the midnight sun up there and stuff. But holy shit, to these actors, do I give them every award there is for shooting out here in the desert, like on these speeding cars in these conditions. I mean, there's a lot of shots and, you know, a lot of setups, and I'm sure there were a lot of terrible, terrible, uncomfortable hours out there. So just thinking about that too is just a marvel for my mind to sort of wrap itself around.
I think I read that they shot a lot of this in, like, Namibia, like just in the Western African deserts. And from what I was reading, like, a lot of the cast members became, like, really close because, like, there's nothing out there. A lot of them became close. Apparently, Tom Hardy was a real pain in the ass to work with on this movie because I think he just had no idea what this was going to become. Like, Charlize, apparently, they both said, while making this movie and after the fact, like, we didn't know what this was going to be. And George Miller's just doing, like, these crazy things, like, having them do, like, these, you couldn't tell what it was going to become. And then they saw the movie, they're like, holy shit, like, he was right. But apparently Tom Hardy was, like, a real asshole, went so far as to, like, apologize, at least to George Miller, I don't know about to Charlize, but, like, apologize to George Miller after the fact, like, oh, like, I should have trusted you all along. But I can't imagine, like, that probably was partly because, like, you're living in the middle of nowhere Africa for weeks or months or whatever, and just, you don't know what you're doing. You don't know the extent to which you're making it. Like, you might have seen the storyboards, you might have read the script, but, like, you don't know what this is going to look like until Margaret Sixel does her magic to this. Like, I can't imagine not knowing, like, the scale and the scope to what this is going to be.
I feel like him being angry kind of fits his character anyway.
Yeah.
That's kind of who he is in the movie, too. You know, there's only a couple times where he gives, even with Furiosa, who he kind of builds this not quite trusting relationship with, but yeah, kind of. Fun fact, Tom Hardy and Charlize's stunt doubles met and fell in love on this movie, and they're married now.
Oh, yeah, and cool. Riley Keough met her husband, that was another stunt double on this movie, and they met on the set here and got married, too. So, like, love is in the air when you're in the middle of nowhere Africa.
The main girl out of, like, the escapees, isn't she Jason Statham's wife in real life? I don't think they met on the set or anything, but I saw that looking around.
And Mike, we have now covered both of her major acting roles, both in this and in Transformers 3 for all his movies. Like, you know, we have completed, I think, as far as I can tell, the Rosie Huntington-Whiteley filmography in terms of podcasts.
That's awesome. We have a hidden podcast hidden within our podcast.
It just took, you know, 3 years apart or whatever to finish it, or 2 years apart. So yeah, the five wives are Abby Lee from Neon Demon. We got Riley Keough from Magic Mike. I'm just talking about, like, what podcast, and also American Honey, which I guess we didn't do, but we will for some podcasts at some point.
Eventually, we'll get back to that for Shia, I feel, at some day.
And if not that, for sure, Pit Stop on Too Fast, Too Forever. We've got Zoe Kravitz, who does not look like, again, hair blindness does not look like her at all to me, but it is what it is. We have Rosie Huntington-Whiteley, and then we have Courtney Eason, who I just don't know. Like, it feels like there's these four that, like, they're not all necessarily famous now. Like, Abby Lee's not a huge actress, and, like, you know, Rosie Huntington-Whiteley's been in two movies, and Riley Keough's not really that well-known, but, like, to have a fifth person who's just, like, I don't know who you are just sort of feels strange, but, like, collectively as a unit, like, they just work So, like, it feels like there is, like, this bond, there is this love there that propels them forward, that, like, as they're facing desperation in the desert, like, they have each other, they're not going to leave each other behind. And when Rosie dies, when she gets, you know, falls off and gets run over, like, you feel it.
They're a very interesting group. To me, like, are they the only ones that represent diversity, you know, in this movie? Because, like, they are sort of, like, you know, a cross-section of, you know, I feel like, the different races and cultures and stuff that have since fallen to the wayside in society and stuff. But that's what it feels like to me, because the rest of this movie is just like kind of just like so white. And Immortan Joe is just like this old white dude who sits on top of his white tower and everything. But so like that was just this time.
He's got an army of white boys.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, so like that this time was, I'm trying to figure out like here on the air. I mean, it's just these thoughts and stuff that are coming to me now.
There's also like an entire population that I assume these women were pulled from that you don't really get to see except, you know, they're kind of like covered in rags. You can't see who they are. But why are all the war boys white?
It's like there's two. I had actually two thoughts about that. The first one is the Mad Max films are just built on like symbols and symbology, really. Like a lot of the same sort of images permeate throughout the movies. And in Beyond Thunderdome, there was a character called Screwloose who looks exactly like one of the war boys. He's all white with black eyes, and he actually has like a short black mohawk. He doesn't have like a painted forehead, but he looks just like them. So on one hand, I just think Miller really loves that look and wanted to have that represented here on a major scale. And then the other idea I had was just that Immortan Joe, he needs everyone. They're all his sons, so they all have to look like him. So they all have to be white with like sunken eyes and stuff. And they're not allowed to have hair because he's like the main lion of the pride and everything.
I mean, there are, I guess, splashes of diversity, if you want to call that, like in, among his people. Like there is the Doof Worry, who we've mentioned a couple times, whose guitar, I think, weighed like 130 pounds or something, the actual guitar itself. The other, like, there's a couple drivers that look different. There is the little person who is in that, like, wheelchair propped up thing, whatever. Like, there are, like, these, it almost feels like if you look different, like, you get prominence in your role. Like, I don't know, like, I agree with Jordan that, like, the wives probably came from the population, like, oh, she's beautiful, let's take her. But then I also wonder if, like, wives become mothers? You know, like, the milk the factories, milkers, if you will, like, once they're past childbirthing age, or if those are different people. Like, I'm sort of glad that we don't get real explanations, because it sort of lets you either, if you want to think about it, you can think about it, or if you don't really care, you can just sort of like let it go and just sort of be engrossed in the action or whatever.
But it's important that the war boys are just this kind of homogeneous just mix of suicide warriors, essentially, since all of Immortan Joe and his kingdom really does, I guess this apocalypse, instead of being the polar ice caps melting in Waterworld or something like that, or I know it says it's like a nuclear fallout world, but really this world is death by capitalism. Like, we have Immortan Joe representing the death grip of the capitalists on the people, commodifying water and turning fucking like milk into, and women into a commodity, lording that over the populace. And the entire movie is about the people taking that back from kind of the bourgeois. Like, it is important that it has like a quote unquote working class of the war boys who are just willing to either break out against it in rare cases like Nux, or throw themselves into the machine for the, you know, their corporate overlord. So for them to be homogenous, I think is symbolically and textually kind of relevant outside of just like, you know, they're all white.
Yeah. I think even more so today too, when you look at our current political climate and who the president is, and then the people that just follow him blindly off of cliffs, you know, daily, you know, off of steeper and steeper cliffs. And it's just like them, with how they've sort of made him, Immortan Joe, into like this religious figure where, you know, they sacrifice themselves and, you know, they talk about going to Valhalla and all this stuff, and they spray their mouths chrome to sort of imitate Immortan Joe's chrome grill on his face and everything, like at the very end there. And so, like, yeah, it's, you know, the politics in these movies are really on its sleeve. It's not hiding anything there, because they have to be, because it's first and foremost like a car chase, crash bang, you know, crazy movie. So like, to be able to smuggle any kind of message in is really great, and for it to sort of hit well is even better. The politics of like Thunderdome are very interesting too, because, you know, you have Tina Turner running shit, you know,
what?
This strong black woman there.
I didn't know that.
Really?
Yeah, and then underground, you have a very interesting mix with Master Blaster, where you have like a little person and someone who's learning disabled running stuff underground. It's not unlike Rictus and his brother in this movie. It's sort of got like a different version of Master Blaster in this, but they're not connected. They're sort of separate in this movie. But again, in that movie too, though, it's all very kind of blatant or obvious. And it's not that it's hidden, but it's just more about the action, I feel. But again, it's cool that it's there too.
Just look at Immortan Joe's speech when he before he dumps the water. It's like such a propaganda political kind of stump speech.
What's sort of interesting to me, and I think, you know, we've been mentioning it a couple times, so like as we are going through Cinemakers of Christopher Nolan, like it feels like this movie sort of fits in, like not that Christopher Nolan could have or would have made this movie, but in a way it kind of feels like it fits into his filmography in that, like, if you want to just absorb this as an action movie, you can, but if you want to look deeper and look for metaphors and look for symbology and stuff, like, you can also do that too. And I think this does it better, or, you know, there's less drawbacks than in a lot of Christopher Nolan movies.
Less clutter, right?
Like, yes.
Yeah, that's it. He's only trying to tackle one or two things as opposed to, like, six or seven.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, this is sort of, I guess, in a way then, like, the ultimate Christopher Nolan movie. Like, it's an action movie that people are going to love, but it's also a movie that has themes and has points that it wants to make. And when action movies are more than just action movies and also happen to be, like, really kick-ass action movies, like, that just is the best.
There's also something that's really rhythmic about the driving. Like, if you told me I would like watching a car chase for 2 hours, I'd be like, no, I don't know. You need to, like, break it up. It can be a lot. And they do such a good job of it having a pace, even though it's, like, constantly moving the whole time. Like, it's mesmerizing. I want to watch it move the whole time.
I think what was kind of smart is making the whole movie the car stuff, because it's in the other films, but it's usually held till the end for like the climax, at least in Road Warrior and Thunderdome. Like this mirrors the first Mad Max, I think, more than the other two as far as like car action and sheer like insanity.
As we're recording this, I'm rewatching. I want to just make special note of like one of the coolest thumbs up in cinema history when Rosie Unwetly falls out of the truck and she catches on and Max just turns around and looks out the window and just gives her the thumbs up, and then I mean she falls and dies there.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking of like the famous thumbs up of movies like from Terminator 2 or like The Guest, another movie with another great thumbs up. Like, I mean, this has got to be on the Mount Rushmore thumbs up, I think.
Hell yeah.
What's the thumbs up in The Guest?
The thumbs up in The Guest is at the end, right? Where the boy stabs him and he says, I'm proud of you.
Good job, yeah.
Oh my gosh, I don't remember that. That's the only movie I've ever watched twice in one day.
It's pretty perfect. Especially because that movie is basically Halloween mashed up with The Terminator, and just to sort of, in a way, take from The Terminator is great, but yeah.
Can I ask you guys a question? There's so many of them in this movie that I feel like even if you don't realize you have one, like everyone has one. What is your favorite thing from the beginning of the movie that is paid off at the end of the movie? Because this is like a screenwriter entire 101 class on just like setup and payoff in the most beautiful ways possible.
I think watching it the first time, I knew they were drawing so much attention to him being like a blood bag, which is which is such a crazy concept, like the idea that he's just like, strap my blood bag to the car and take him with us. Like, so I think the idea that came back, that he has to give a blood transfusion at the end to Furiosa, that was just, again, Chris, to sort of take from you, chef kiss, mwah. Right in the air for me.
Yeah.
You know, watching this movie, again, that whole sequence, like I was already sort of tearing up and stuff, but that gave it an extra push because of like the screenwriting. I was like, oh, they know what they're doing so well.
Yeah, and that's the action hero's, like, that's the thing he does in this movie. He doesn't like leap off of Nakatomi Plaza, run away from a boulder. Mad Max's big like moment of badassness is to give Furiosa his blood, and it's so good.
I think one of my favorite things is not necessarily like a setup and payoff, but I just love the symbology of, there's so many times in this movie where like somebody is either literally or metaphorically chained to someone or something else. I think that constant running motif throughout the movie is really interesting, that like whether they're physically, like whether Max is chained to Nux, he has to carry him across the desert, or you know, like through a door, or like whatever, or like, you know, he gets his hand pinned to the steering wheel, all sorts of different stuff like that. Like there's just like these like beautiful like through lines of dependence and link and bonds that just, you know, whether you're actually tied to someone or not, that it just visually throughout the movie. I think it's just, it's wonderful.
That's really cool, Joey, because I didn't think of how symbolic that ends up being, because they almost form like this unbreakable chain like bond by the end when they're on their way back, and they're almost like this pseudo family fast and forever.
And it's a tethered chain that spells the end for old Immortan Joe as well.
That's right. That's right. He gets faced.
Yeah.
I'm going to say, unless Jordan has one, do you?
Kind of. I mean, I really, really like this message about women that gets set up pretty instantly once we realize that Furiosa has the wives and they're like, no, fuck you. We're not objects. You can't keep us. And then that they go collect these other women and then they all go back together to wreak havoc and, you know, win eventually. That's really, really powerful.
I mentioned ugly crying before, and I tweeted out maybe 3 or 4 months ago when I was watching this with someone who had never seen it before, that I had to like steel myself at certain points in the movie, and then like at the big moment I actually had to leave the room because I knew what was going to happen if I had stuck around. The dichotomy in the first time that Nux says witness me and the last time is fucking beautiful.
Yeah, that was also one of my ugly cries.
Yeah, Nick Holt is kind of disappears in this role. Like, I'm not really privy to a lot of his. I remember him as a child star more, and then I basically consider him to be Beast in X-Men. But, I mean, we just watched him in another Charlize movie, and he's totally forgettable in that. And
well, everything's totally forgettable in that movie.
Dark Places. Movie should be buried in a dark place, every copy. But here, yeah, he just embodies Nux, and when you just know he's dying from the first frame you see him. They're just talking about how he's on his last limb and stuff, or he's like about to just keel over. The sympathy that is built up toward him from me throughout this movie is incredible.
Mm-hmm. Moments with him that get me, when him and Max exchange the boot back and forth the first time, like when he like completely humiliates himself in front of his god, the redhead wives, just like her immediate empathy and like nurturing of him, and then him immediately just like taking the chain and like finding like a family, and just so many moments with Nux. Like, I can't watch the movie anymore knowing what happens and not get extremely emotional watching him and his performance throughout Mad Max. It's, I think he's like, I know this is Watch the Throne, but I feel like Nick Holt is like the secret MVP of this movie.
I forgot somehow like how tender his moments are with Riley Keough, with Capable. Like, you know, they form this bond like out of nowhere. Like, she comes from a place where she can't really trust any men, and just in the matter of like bonding through circumstance, like they seem to genuinely have something in this movie. Like the characters, the actors, whatever, but like it's not like the emotional core of this movie, but like it's an emotional core of this movie. Like, they are so good together, and like this embodiment of like this, you know, these mismatched duo or whatever.
And he has the biggest transformation in, you know, one day. Mm-hmm. And if you think about it and read into that and think about all the other broken war boys who, with a little empathy, could be completely different people, it's just the saddest.
Yeah, and it's kind of crazy. Like, at the end, he's the one who says it sounds like hope when Max kind of reveals his plan, you know, and it just makes me think, like, yeah, like, when they get back there and Furiosa's in charge and they're in charge, like, there is hope for those boys. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like they can be reformed now. They'll be like definitely in better hands, but like maybe even the best of hands. And especially Riley Keough, having already sort of converted one, knows how to sort of talk to the rest, perhaps.
And what's kind of cool is that like the younger generation of those boys, like they're the ones who decide to let them up. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, they're all like the crowd is chanting, let them up at the end. And they're the ones who actually jump down to that lower platform and like pull the lever to lower that platform and let the car go on. Like, they're not tainted or corrupted beyond repair in this world yet. Like, they may look the part, but they are not acting the part. They are here for, they're the bright future of tomorrow. They're the ones not ruined by Immortan Joe. They're the ones who are, you know, there for the people, which is, you know, it's cool to see.
And as they're writing that lift up, that last look between Furiosa and Max is just breathtaking. It's so perfectly timed in its editing, and both of them play it in such an understated but understandable way. I love it. I could watch the last like minute of that movie over and over again.
I love how they shot that, where like we by the end of that shot, we're like looking straight up at her, which makes her look like such a powerful badass. Yes. It's so cool.
And what I love about that shot, I don't know, actually, I don't know if we've talked about this on podcast before, but, you know, one critic, one reviewer that I know that Chris and I both love, David Ehrlich, who at every year at the end of the year puts together his video of the top 25 films of his from that year, and this made the list in 2015, and that's one of the shots. Like, I've seen those videos, like those short videos, probably dozens, if not 100 times, so like I know what shots he uses from this movie, and like seeing that shot, or seeing, you know, Max with the shotgun, like saying, no, no, you over there, like these just like iconic moments from this film, all set to Cyndi Lauper's Girls Just Want to Have Fun. Like, my brain is such a weird mishmash, like jumbled up thing, but like that shot is so iconic in multiple ways, and I just love it. I mean, I love that, you know, like Jordan said, like it gives her the power. She's the one who's ascending to the throne, and she's the one in charge. That we're looking at her, and she's looking down at us, and it's her world now.
And that's why this movie is not as good in 2003 with Mel Gibson, because that has to be Mel Gibson's movie. This can't be Mad Max's movie.
You know, it is literally and physically and metaphorically and symbolically all the different things, like a passing of the torch from men to women. Like, it is a Morton Joe to Furiosa. It is Max to Furiosa. It is men in the star of the movie to women in the star of the movie. And like, what I think is like really unique and cool is that aside from Max and Nux, like literally every guy in this movie is evil, and like they don't try to like make you sympathize with any of them. Like, the women are all for almost entirely like good and pure, and then aside from these two guys who sort of learn from them, they're all just terrible men. So I mean, there's no subtlety here about like what this movie is saying, and to have it end that way is awesome.
And you know, I think it's Riley Keeley who says, who destroyed the world? Like, we don't need an answer. Like, we know. We get it from the movie.
So I actually kind of forgot that Furiosa she's not in this movie for the first like 15 minutes, maybe. Like, it does open with Max, which I totally forgot. I hadn't seen this in a while. So then you get to her, and it really feels like she's the main character and he's kind of on the periphery. But I really, really like the last big fight scene. They are separated and fighting at the same time, and it pretty equally cuts back and forth between the two of them, which felt like a really appropriate way to end it and to give both of those characters what they deserve.
Yeah, I almost feel like, to a degree, even though his name is on the title, these movies aren't entirely about Max himself. Like, yes, they're about his adventures and his journeys, but it's mostly Max wanders into town and, like, helps a bunch of people who are being terrorized. Or Max wanders into town, you know, to get his camels back and gets wrapped up in Thunderdome. Or, like, you know, Max gets taken into the Citadel and wrapped up in Furiosa's journey and stuff. I think that's part of why I love this series so well, because you can't really do that with, like, Batman, right? Like, you can't have a Batman movie that's primarily about, well, I guess they tried with about Catwoman, and it turned out pretty good, to be quite honest. That last Dark Knight Rises, he's barely in it. But I think what I'm trying to get at is, like, he isn't necessarily always the main character in his own series, and that's cool. Like, that's definitely weird and unusual, but it works because of the idea, at least, that they're not entirely connected to one another. They are more of just like these folktales or whatever. We're just going to use elements and symbols and have them reoccur and evolve the like the meanings behind them and stuff until we get to this like amazing crescendo where like the first movie could be, you know, a bunch of guys in leather running, or could be just seen as a bunch of guys in leather driving really fast down a highway, and now we are a bunch of women driving a truck through the desert to salvation and stuff. So, like, it's just a really interesting arc overall throughout, like, the course of the franchise.
He's a cowboy with a car.
Yeah, he's a carboy.
Ooh, carboy. I have a bunch of quotes written down, but is there anything else major about this movie, either, you know, the events of the movie or the metaphors or the symbology that we want to make sure that we talk about before we do some odds and ends and then get on to other stuff? Like, I feel like we could talk about it more, but I don't know. I feel like we've done a pretty good job, a pretty thorough job in this last hour. Is there anything else major that we're missing?
The only other thing I feel like mentioning is that George Miller has, like, a really awesome sort of, like, obsession with bungee cords. I don't know if bungee jumping originated down under or where, but in Thunderdome, you're strapped to bungee cords. And in this one, you know, Doof, my man, the Doof Warrior, is strapped to bungee cords. Yeah, it's just, I don't know. That is just, to me, like, so unusual and strange. And again, something I never would think would connect to this universe. And yet, maybe just because of its inherent danger, it seems cool and therefore, like, fits well into this world. But just among things that have shown up previously in other Mad Max movies, like, that makes me laugh the most.
Well, he seems to just have, like, an eye for movement. I can't reference the other ones because I have barely seen them. But, like, the same way, like, you know, Doof Warrior is on the bungee, and, like, the same way, like, the poles are swinging back and forth. It wasn't good enough to just have, like, poles on top of a car, or even just have, like, a big truck driving. But he was like, no, 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 like, it adds a layer of movement to it that's so cool.
One other thing that I think is really important, because this movie is so quickly cut when it's in, especially when it's in the action scenes, and there is so much movement, apparently George Miller told the cinematographer to keep everything, like, keep all the action in the center of the frame. That apparently the cinematographer, the guy named John Seal, said, George Miller basically said, keep the crosshairs on her nose. That, like, there's so much going on, there's so many moving parts, literally and figuratively, in this movie, that they're like, we know there's a shitload going on, we're going to keep the camera focused right on what you need. And apparently it took the guy a while to sort of get used to that kind of shooting, because that's not really what you do. But I think it works, because there is so much crazy stuff going on. Your eyes can look around, but as long as you sort of focus on the middle of the screen, you're getting the core of what, you know, what it's all about.
That definitely worked, because I have that thing where, like, if a movie is cut too fast, which happens in a lot of movies now where there's action, it's cut so fast that I can't see it. And that only happened to me, like, once or twice in this, where I got disoriented.
Yeah, thank goodness this guy shot a movie like it was supposed to be shot, not like just because they wanted to look cool or something handheld and quick or whatever, but like you could just really feel the craft 100% all around in this movie. And just about every shot is gorgeous and perfect. And yeah, like the action holds long enough so that you can tell what's actually going on before it cuts. You know, like every cut is on purpose and not just to cut or because to advance action or whatever. Like this is highly choreographed and probably very storyboarded and everything here. So I'm just so relieved the guy listened to George Miller and that George Miller knew, you know, how to shoot a movie like this, because I don't think everybody would have wanted to shoot it like this, and they would have been wrong.
Two other little things that I have, well, one little thing, one bigger thing. One, apparently Charlize was wearing like this like big green cast so that they could like digitally remove her arm from the movie and then, you know, put in her prosthetic arm in this movie. But she apparently elbowed Tom Hardy in the nose and broke his nose at one point, so there we go, that's something. But this movie also won, I believe, 6 Oscars. Best Achievement in Film Editing, Costume Design, Makeup and Hair, Sound Mixing, Sound Editing, Production Design. It was nominated for Best Picture and was the only film nominated for Best Picture that year that got 0 acting nominations. So I guess it's kind of where it was just like, you know, the acting is good, but it's not, I guess, noteworthy enough to nominate, but everything else about this movie is so phenomenal that, like, we got to make sure that we recognize this movie for what it is.
I think that's even, like, more of a compliment. The idea that, like, no one is doing anything better than anyone. Everyone's at the top of their game or something. Or, like, everybody's working exactly how they should here. Yeah, it would be unfair to sort of single anyone out, I feel.
And the only other little bit of trivia that I have is that the body count in this movie is 110. 34 people killed by Max and 32 killed by Furiosa. So that's a lot of dead bodies in this movie. Probably one of the highest, I would imagine, in a Charlize movie so far, probably, right? If not the highest.
Oh, in a Charlize movie? Yeah, I think so. I mean, I can't imagine it getting... Well, we didn't see how many people died in the story of The Road, but I'm sure...
billions of people.
But yes, as far as like on-screen, for sure.
Anybody else have any other last thoughts before we get on to the games and other segments of the show?
Yeah, real quick, just because I did this with the Nolan stuff, and I try to do this on episodes of Cage Club Universe, things that are irredeemable trash. I try to say one good thing about the trash, and I'll say that my one negative that I still feel every time I watch this movie, though I understand it, I hate the day for night stuff. I think it looks garish, but I understand that shooting in the middle of the desert at night would have like added like $5 million onto the cost of this film. I just think it looks really, really ugly. That is my one negative that I have about this movie. Back to the love fest.
Oh, do you have like the solo Star Wars opening sequence sort of like monochromatic blue complaint thing. I could see, I definitely can see that. It gets a little over the toppy with that. Ultimately, it didn't bother me so much. I did think that the Bullet Man sequence is a little cut short, though. Like, that just sort of feels a little sort of like in and out, as opposed to everything else being very sort of filled out. But I hear you there. I could buy that.
My one complaint sort of similarly is, like, this movie was shot partially or whatever in 3D, and some of the 3D effects look kind of cheesy. Like, when at the end, like, the steering wheel is coming toward the screen, I'm like, okay. But that's like, you know, a couple seconds in an otherwise nearly perfect two-hour movie.
I have one complaint. I don't like the flashbacks. I don't like Max's flashbacks. They make me feel like there's something I'm maybe supposed to understand from the other movies that I don't. And I think this movie is pretty the same without them.
Yeah.
Yeah, they are a little perplexing. I tried to dig a little more into that, and there is a prequel comic book that I didn't have time to read or anything, but I feel like they're from an adventure, you know, that we're not privy to or anything. They're not linked directly to any of the previous movies, only the idea that Max has helped people in the past and he has both failed and succeeded depending on the circumstances here. So I just got a sense that it was his haunted past. But I do hear you. It is sort of, I don't want to say it's like out of place or anything, but it is a little jarring because they're not consistent. They're just in the very beginning and then they come back at the very end there. So I almost just like completely forget about them, and then they come back and I'm like, oh yeah, like they didn't really need to come back, but I hear you there.
Mike, do you have any other thoughts about Fury Road before we move on?
No, I'm just, you know, I'm so glad we made it here. I'm so glad that we stuck it out, because I love this movie, I love this franchise, and it's just been a lot of fun rewatching all these movies this month. So yeah, when it drops, be sure to check out the Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome episode with Brian and Kara. It's going to be, you know, we get into the rest of the series and all the craziness that's on display over in Bartertown. So check us out.
Well, the first segment that we have on the after the discussion is Unfortunate Improv, which, you know, we debuted a new game, was it last week, I believe, on Dark Places with Tobin. The new game, Mike's game, Stan Lee Yourself. So if we won a walk-on role into this movie, if we were just in one quick little scene in this movie, where would you be? What would you be doing? Would you have lines? Describe it to us. Jordan, I know you've been gripping your water bottle tightly. Hopefully you've relaxed a little bit as we've talked about it. But Jordan, if you had to put yourself in this movie, how would you Stan Lee yourself into Mad Max Fury Road?
So after I first saw this, I very specifically remember thinking that during my lifetime, I have to climb around the outside of a car that is moving. So I would stick myself doing that. I don't need a line. I can totally just be like a stunt person in the background. That's what I want to do, though.
You want to play like Ship's Mast, but like in the desert.
Yeah. Well, because you know how like they're constantly like, you drive, and then they just like climb out the window and like they're crawling all over the place? That's what I want to do.
Cool.
Real goal that I think I can actually achieve also.
Chris, how would you Stan Lee yourself into Fury Road?
Boy, if I'm Stan Lee in the apocalypse, there's so many more ways to fuck over Jack Kirby.
True.
But instead, I will just say I think it would be fun to be... What if there was like a tiny car that had like Doof Warrior's bassist on it that's like immediately blown up before it even gets in out?
We don't need a rhythm section in the apocalypse.
Yeah. Oh, he rides his rhythm section. They're like all the drummers behind him. But there is no bassist. I like the idea of sidecar bass player that just gets immediately annihilated as soon as they pull out into the desert.
Mike, what would you do? How would you Stanley yourself?
I guess, you know, I'd have to probably go with being a war boy of some type. I'd probably be the guy who's like, okay, so like they're all lowering the trucks on the chains and everything's going nuts and they're all getting ready. So I'm the guy gassing them up, going like, all right, guys, like I'm going to hold down the fort here at the Citadel. Catch you when you get back. Everything's going to be fine. Just like you left it. Good luck. So that's me. I'm going to be the one they leave behind.
You're like the one grown-up war boy that they leave behind to babysit all the little war boys.
There you go. Yeah, I'm the nanny. I'm the...
the manny.
I'm trying to think how I would Stan Lee myself into this movie, because I feel like everything I'm thinking of would make me just feel like a terrible character. I feel like I would just be one of the water-hungry people. Get like a featured extra shot. Like, there are people, like, there's so much like hideous makeup in this movie, like the guy who has like the just gigantic feet that are just being tended to by the war boys. There's Immortan Joe's like bubbly pussy front, like chest and back. there is, you know, the guy with the weird jaw and the weird teeth. Like, there's so many mutations and deformities in this world. Just, make me up to be, like, a real weird-looking dude, and then just stick me in the front, like, hunting for water. I'm cool with that.
Nice. Nice.
So we have an email address on the show, watch@cageclub.me. No email today. We are nearing the end, sort of, kind of Watch a Throne. Mike and I this week outlined the rest of the show in terms of when things are coming out.
The end's in sight.
Yeah, another 12 episodes, I believe, after this. That'll take us from the Huntsman Winter's War next week all the way through the silver and chrome, the black and chrome wallpapers or whatever in November, on November 16th. Between here and then, we have 12 episodes, I think, so a lot left, but we sort of mapped out where we're going to be, what we're going to do. Email us. Let us know what you thought of the ride so far. Let us know what you thought of Fury Road. If you don't like Fury Road, I guess, let us know, but...
Oh, does that person exist?
Maybe.
I'd love to hear from them.
Do you think there is someone?
I don't know. We'll find out.
That guy is a Twitter war boy who just sprays his mouth with, like, spray cheese and yells at women into Valhalla.
Yeah. The last thing we have to do on the show is the awards segment. Now, Mike, you know, a couple episodes ago... We somehow nominated A Million Ways to Die in the West for 12 things, many of which were positive, somehow. Will we surpass that here? Best film, Mad Max Fury Road.
Check.
Best Charlize role, Imperator Furiosa.
Check.
Most badass role, Imperator Furiosa.
Double check.
Best outfit wardrobe? Do we count the arm?
I mean, yeah, right? Like, sure. She's in full post-apocalyptic, you know, desert garb. She's even got a shoulder pad, like, in true Mad Max fashion. I didn't even realize, but she's wearing
one. The steampunk goggles, too.
Yeah. Best non-Charlize death, Immortan Joe getting his face ripped off?
You know what? I might go with the one war boy where he first, like, he gets an arrow in his face and chest, and then he gets up. And it's early in the chase. Sprays himself and he jumps in slow motion.
And they witness him?
That guy? Yeah. The first guy we witnessed.
War boy witnessed. I'm gonna nominate both, because why not?
Sure.
Best fight, I wrote down, there is that fight where, when they first sort of come face-to-face, that there is a really long, really kind of gritty Max Furiosa fight, which is pretty cool.
With the chain, he's like chained to Nux still and everything. That's an awesome fight.
Something that video that I saw pointed out, which I never noticed and I loved, is that during that fight, Furiosa attempts to murder Max twice with a gun, like point-blank tries to shoot him. And fails. And the moment that their relationship begins is when he wins that fight and actively chooses to not shoot her when he has the chance, which I never noticed and I absolutely love.
I love it. Now, is there a best line? Do we have a best line for Charlize that we want to? Like, there's so many good lines in this movie. Is there one of hers that we want to nominate?
That's the thing. Like, does she have any of the real sort of, like, one-liners? Because, you know, all the stuff like Shiny and Chrome and Witness Me and all the... Those are all the war boys and everything, mostly saying that. But I can't really... I don't know.
Well, she does have, when she... I think it's her. Doesn't she say, "Remember me," to Immortan Joe when he gets his face ripped off?
Oh, yeah, at the very end. That reminded me just because... Reminded me of the end of Coco for some reason.
Oh,
Remember
boy. Okay.
Me. That
sure.
song, I mean, Remember Me.
Very different, but...
I know, but it just popped into my head, and I was like, oh, that's funny.
I'm just... Some of their quotes, not hers, that are great that I'm not going to nominate, but, like, he looked at me. He looked right at me. I am awaited in Valhalla.
I love just the language. Like, this and Thunderdome do amazing things with language and just the idea of how language survives after worldwide communication breaks down and generations are grown up without being educated and stuff, but I mean, the idea of calling each other half-lives and stuff and, you know, anti-seed for a bullet and the earth being sour. Just like, I just love, you know, the language in this movie and just in the series in general.
And I love the theatricality of it, too. Like, when that guy who is sort of sniping at them from afar or, like, shooting at them with a light and, you know, Charlize hits the light with the last bullet and he goes blind and he's just like, "I am the scales of justice, conductor of the choir of death. Sing, Brother Heckler. Sing, Brother Koch." And he just starts shooting blindly. He's like, "Sing, brother, sing." It's just like, who is this guy? Like, where did he come? Like, just like, what?
Just madness.
And
just
also,
madness.
Right before that is great. You know, Charlize, when she got one bullet left, she just says, don't breathe. And, yeah. You know, that's pretty cool.
I love that when he gives the gun to her, because he's like, he misses, and then he lines it up again, and she's like breathing down his neck a little and kind of going like, eh, eh. And he has like the sense to realize we got one shot left. She's probably the better shot. I'm gonna like, it's not even that he has any pride or anything like that. It's just he knows, like, just she's better than me.
I also like, there's like a, I feel like we've probably had a few times in Charlize Theron movies where she's got that like little bit of an aside. They go to drop off the guzzoline in that canyon, and they're like, you said there's gonna be maybe a few vehicles, I see three war camps or whatever. And she's like, just says to herself, like, yeah, well, I got unlucky, like, you know, like what do you want from me, like, I'm trying to give you this, but like, I got unlucky. I like that. And the only other line that I have that I really, really like, it's from one of the wives, it might be from Rosie, where she says, is that the wind or is that just a furious fixation? You know, the war rig, like the crew's coming party after them.
She's the one from Neon Demon, right?
She's Rosie's from Transformers 3. Abby Lee, I don't know who says that. Other one is from Neon Demon, yes.
To me, she's like the most interesting of the five wives, because she almost seems like a war girl to a degree. Like, she's all pale and has like a kind of skull kind of look to her in a weird kind of way. But I really love that. I like her image in this movie.
Best cinematography, best score soundtrack.
The score is just, you know, those pounding drums are just, I mean, what more do you need, really? There's a little bit of melody going throughout here, but I mostly just like, whatever, just play that rock guitar over the pounding drums and you've got a Mad Max movie.
Now, the only other thing of note, and I want Jordan and Chris's input on this, is there someone other than Charlize we should nominate for best or worst, but probably best, non-Charlize actor, male or female? Do we nominate Tom Hardy? Do we nominate a wife? Do we nominate Nicholas Holt? Do we nominate, you know, Immortan Joe? Like, who in this movie, or do we not? Like, I mean, you know, the Academy didn't. We don't have to.
I think it would have to be Nicholas Holt if it's somebody.
Completely agreed. If it's somebody, it's him.
He really sneaks up on you how good he is.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't expect... I remember the first time seeing this, I did not expect him to last that, like, the entire movie, basically. Like, I just thought... I don't even think I knew it was Nick Holt. I just was like, what is this? They're just going to be, you know, throwing these guys at the problem, and, like, we're just getting a second to meet one of them. But I love how he gets singled out and developed.
And, you know, Jordan, we talked about this last week when we talked about Dark Places where he was in, but do you remember one of the very first episodes of Cage Club Revisited we did, The Weatherman with you, he plays Nicolas Cage's son.
Oh, he's one of the kids? I don't remember that.
He has an inappropriate relationship with one of his teachers.
Yep.
I must have blacked it all out.
Probably for the best.
You blacked out when he took his shirt off at the table and his teacher took pictures of him.
Are you sure I did that movie?
Yep.
Yeah, because it was pretty depressing. We were sitting around going, man, this movie's depressing.
And you had never seen it.
I do
remember
that part.
Yep, it was you. So anything else of note in this movie, good or bad, but probably good, that we want to nominate Mad Max Fury Road for?
Can you nominate Do For You for something?
We do have a category.
A very special award.
Best musician turned actor. You know, best, I don't know.
Best mutant
best
freak.
Best blind guitarist.
We could give him a special award. I don't know. Like, it just...
Like, what category, Joe? We'd have to create, like, some kind of category. Like, I feel like Mighty Joe Young and him can be in the same category somehow. Like,
most larger-than-life performance.
Like, weirdest character or something. I don't know.
Maybe. But as of right now, we have this nominated for 11 categories. Best film, best role, most badass role, best outfit wardrobe, best non-Charlie's death twice, best fight, best line, best cinematography, best score, and best male actor role for Nicholas Holt. 11 did not. It could not touch the prolific nature of A Million Ways to Die in the West, but really, what can?
It's just that's just its legacy, I guess.
It's just its legacy. But before we go, I want to thank both Jordan and Chris for being on the show. We will do our little podcast feature of both Wistful Thinking and Now and Again. Now and Again is in the middle of a 2-month, sort of 4-episode long journey through Rolling Stone's 100 Greatest Songs of the Century so far. That's also going to include the next episode on September 1st. Will include, I believe, Chris, correct me if I'm wrong or confirm if I'm right, the retrospective of, like, Rolling Stone's cultural significance?
Correct. With a friend of multiple Cage Club shows, Jared Brown.
Who was on our Italian Job episode. So check that out.
Are you going to watch the Rolling Stone documentary, too? Wasn't there one of those recently or
no,
something?
No, I don't know if there is. But we're mostly going through a list that is normally as bad as most top 100 whatever lists are, but occasionally surprising, but will only get worse as it approaches the top 50 spoilers for next month's episode.
Well, I really like that list. I really like the Rolling Stone list. I'm going to just say it right now. You guys are also very critical and negative about a lot of things, so of course you wouldn't like it, but I enjoy that list. So
I used to read Rolling Stone a lot, like in the 90s. I had a subscription to Rolling Stone.
We like the list until the top 10, and then it gets very Rolling Stone-y.
Well, yeah, sure. That's fine.
It had some Carly Rae Jepsen on it, which is sometimes all we ask for on that.
And two Robin songs? I mean, that's, come on. Mm-hmm. And I also feel like Annie, I just that one song by Annie, like I need to listen to more Annie, but I feel like she is sort of in that pantheon of, you know, the Chris Nico, Joey emotion thread on Facebook. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like Annie kind of maybe could be in there.
Tune in, find out.
Ooh. I do remember in high school, my only really memory about Rolling Stone is that, like, when I was a junior, Rolling Stone was offering a 50-year subscription for $99.
A 50-year subscription?
And I did not do it. But my teacher and my friend both did theirs, so... I remember my teacher was like 48 at the time. He's like, the only thing that's like bothers me about this is like when I'm 98, I'm gonna have to re-up on my subscription to Rolling Stone. But yeah, 50 years for $100.
Oh man, imagine 2003, Rolling Stone editors were like, print will never die. Give it all away. Give it to them for free. This can't possibly go wrong.
I know. That's what it was. And we also have Jordan from Wistful Thinking. Jordan, this episode comes out next Friday, which is the day after Boatcast 3. What's Boatcast 3 going to be?
Boatcast 3 is a Nicole Kidman movie called... Shit, I forgot what it's called.
I love
called.
That movie.
Oh, Dead Calm.
Dead Silent.
Dead Calm.
Something.
Dead Calm.
Dead Calm. Ooh. That will be the second to last... No, that will be the last Boatcast movie for August, and then we go into musicals.
Ooh. Did you hear today that Wes Anderson's next movie is going to be a musical set in, like, post-World War II Europe or something?
I did, and somebody good's in it.
I don't know that. I believe that, though.
Probably Jeff Goldblum, Bill Murray, a Wilson brother.
Yeah.
That's right. He doesn't use different actors. Nope. Never mind.
But yeah, so Boatcast is great. I also, when you guys said you were doing Dead Calm, I also sent you a link to an X-Files episode called Dodd Calm or whatever, which is also on a boat, which is, I guess, named after the movie? I don't know. What I'm more interested in is another Nicole Kidman movie, BMX Bandits, which I really want to watch because I just watched Rad, and Rad fucking ruled. And on the How Did This Get Made episode, they were like, Jason Mantzoukas was talking about how good BMX Bandits is, so... Another young Nicole Kidman movie.
Wow. Well, yeah, look at her hair.
I watched both of those as a very youngling. I remember renting those at the Video Dynamics, especially that Nicole Googling Kidman this. One. I was like, loved BMXing.
Oh, Jordan, God. If you want to convince Kara to do BMX Bandits, I would love to do that episode with you.
This is wild. This is like when you see the Kylie Minogue video for the Locomotion. This is out of control. Holy shit.
Well, you're all welcome. I haven't seen the movie yet, but I can't imagine that I will do anything but love it. And also go see Rad, because Rad is so good.
I think I liked BMX Bandits more when I was a kid, but I haven't watched them in like 30 years. So
I was watching Rad on a plane back from Scotland and laughing out loud on the plane just out of pure joy. Like, I was like, this is the best.
Send me an angel.
So thank you, Jordan. Thank you, Chris, so much for being on here talking about Fury Road, for essentially capping off Watch the Throne. I mean, we've got a handful more episodes that are going
to
be really
But basically,
good.
This is what we wanted to do it for. Yep. So we got here. We made it.
But thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
I'm trying to load the thing right now. This might be a... Oh, no. Jordan will be on one more episode. She'll be on Tully in a couple months. So come back for that.
Yeah.
But this is a series wrap for Chris. So thank you, Chris, for all of your contributions to the Watch the Throne history.
I'm very happy I got to be here for Fury Road. And the other movies I was on, I guess. What else? What was in my run? Hancock?
Oh, Hancock, sure. How could we forget Hancock?
My other one was Celebrity.
Jordan, you were also on Sweet November.
Oh, shit, I was on Sweet November.
Oh, Chris, you're also on Arrested Development, where your whole face was British.
Of course. How could I ever possibly forget Wee Britain and my time with Mr. F?
For all things Watch the Throne, all of those episodes, all the episodes that are coming up, everything that we've done, all 39 so far, you can go to cageclub.me, facebook.com/cageclub, or at cageclubpod on Twitter and Instagram. Email us, watch@cageclub.me. Let us email you, cageclub.me/newsletter. The next newsletter is going to go out on September 1st. We'll have a teaser, taster, sneak preview, a hint of such, to the two podcasts that Mike and I are going to do next.
You heard it right. Two new podcasts.
Two new podcasts.
Double down.
And then we will officially announce them on this feed on November 2nd. So stay tuned for that. We've got cool things coming up. We learned from this podcast, let's just watch good movies. So hopefully these two new ones will be better than most of what we got through for this podcast. Ugh. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
And I'm Mike Manzi.
And that was Jordan Poland Clark and Chris Mattiello. We'll see you next time as we ride shiny and chrome into Valhalla for the Huntsman Winter's War? Cool, sure, why not? Bye!